This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Governor Malloy's former chief of staff has a new gig. He's heading up the state college system that has had two presidents and two interim leaders in just the few years since it was created. Meanwhile, Malloy himself is stumping for Hillary Clinton at a time when her campaign isn't exactly running as well as she'd hoped. And if Clinton really wants to know what's on voters' minds, maybe she should come to one of Connecticut's DMV headquarters, where people have been waiting in long, sweaty lines as the state fixes its computer system. Those are just a few of the stories we will cover today in The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Join the conversation. 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Later in the program, we'll say goodbye to two New England baseball institutions, leaving after a few decades of entertaining us, the New Britain Rockcats and Red Sox announcer Don Orsillo. I have to unfortunately start with some news. We're going to share our thoughts with WDBJ, a local television affiliate in Virginia, where a gunman opened fire during a live shot this morning. Both the reporter Allison Parker and the photographer Adam Ward were killed. People in our business, especially the local television end of our business, take an awful lot of grief from politicians and others for just doing their jobs. Whenever journalists are killed anywhere in the world, it is something that hits our profession very deeply, and I want to let our colleagues know that we're thinking about them today. Joining us today, as always, Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello once again, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Christine Stewart is here. She is editor of ctnewsjunkie.com. Hello, Christine.
Good morning, John.
And Dan Haar, he's a columnist for The Hartford Current. Hello once again, Danny.
Good morning.
So, first of all, let's start with General Electric. One of the state's biggest corporations is being courted now by other states. Connecticut is trying to convince General Electric to stay. Governor Malloy says he's been talking to them.
We would like them to remain in the state. They have been approached by other states over the years, states that they have larger employee numbers in. We understand it's a competitive situation, as it is with many of our large employers.
One of the things GE seems upset about, and we've been talking about this for weeks now, is they're upset that Connecticut has adopted a unitary tax, which I'm sure Dan Haar will explain to us in just a moment. Of the states that have been recently mentioned in active talks with GE, only the state of Georgia does not already have a unitary tax. Both Texas and New York have had that requirement longer than Connecticut. First of all, Colin, what do you see in all this? The Malloy administration saying, we're going to go after GE, make sure they stay.
This is sort of the problem with federalism, right? I mean, that you wind up in this kind of race to the bottom as states compete with one another rather than functioning cooperatively as a country. So you can hear in Dan Malloy's voice and in his words, he, as governor of Connecticut, is basically reduced to standing on GE's front lawn, holding a boombox over his head, playing a Peter Gabriel song, you know? And Andrew Cuomo is reduced to the sort of sleazy guy at the bar saying, what's it going to take to get you to come home with me? And, you know, Cuomo is probably offering them too much. Malloy, if he's going to make a counteroffer, is going to have to offer them too much. And inevitably, you're also creating a situation where every other corporate citizen of your state is looking there and saying, what, are you going to do some special carve-out for them? But I've got to live with all these other consequences. So I don't know exactly what the solution is, although I feel like federal leadership, I mean, like, you know, federal leadership, not federalist leadership, is needed somehow. I mean, states are hurting themselves through this process.
States are hurting themselves through this process, and as Colin is suggesting, maybe the federal government, Christine, step in and take a look at if it makes sense to have a whole bunch of employees move from one place to another and ruin the tax rolls of Connecticut to benefit a place like Georgia. What's the governor saying, and what else are you hearing at the Capitol about this?
Well, you know, this kind of shell game happens all the time. Like Colin said, you know, states are competing against each other to move companies from one place to another. I think the danger with GE being courted by New York is that Westchester County is so close that these employees would simply, you know, continue to live here and then commute to New York. So they would continue paying income taxes, presumably here in Connecticut. So it wouldn't be a total loss.
Well, let's just stop there for a second. If they were continuing to pay their personal taxes to the state of Connecticut, we have known for a long time that GE doesn't, you know, pay a whole lot of corporate taxes anyway. So what's the big deal?
Yeah, I think Dan did a piece on that recently, so he might be better to talk about it.
Danny?
Well, this could be one of the worst kept financial secrets in taxation. The opponents of GE have been saying all along that, well, gee, the company, based on what we can see from their filings and from their statements, it appears that they don't pay any state income tax. other than the $250 annual minimum. And in fact, sources...
Every pizza shop pays, but anyway, please.
That's right. Well, that's exactly right. And you have to pay it twice in some cases because you pay it to register and you pay it a year in your income tax. But I did confirm, by the way, that that is the case with people who could lose their jobs if they, you know, if it were known that they that they said that. But the reality here is, and first of all, in answer to Colin's question, there may not be much we can do about it. The state of Connecticut could do away with the corporate earnings tax, and it wouldn't be such a bad thing because it's a completely unfair tax. It's paid largely by middle market firms. The big companies move money around deftly, and GE would be no different in any other state. It's not going to pay state income taxes anywhere, even in states that have it. Connecticut could do itself a favor by stopping wasting money collecting it. It amounts to between $700 and $800 million a year. It creates about $1.7 to $1.8 million, a billion dollars, yeah, a year in anger toward it. And if you want to tax corporations, which we do, I'm a good card carrying tax and spend liberal, never met a tax I didn't like. This is a dumb one. Just tax income. Raise the income tax because you get a refund back from the federal government at the end of the year. Just raise income taxes if you need money. I'm not saying you need to raise taxes, but that's one solution.
But it's one solution, but a solution that I'm going to guess, Dan, that probably nobody at the state capitol is going to take from you.
Why? Because the Republicans certainly don't like the corporate earnings tax, and Democrats are really frustrated by this because you can't – there's no way to cut when Roland about 10 or 12 years ago tried to – he was going to cut the loopholes. Right. And so he decided to go after the $400 million in exemptions to the corporate earnings tax. And he came up with not $1 because every dollar that's there is lobbied to its death. And you can't do it. So why try?
Colin?
I mean, I agree with Dan that what we need is clarity. So, I mean, part of this is the problem. Part of the problem here is our patchwork approach to taxation. You know, I mean, politically, it's very unappetizing to actually raise the income tax. So that's why they don't do it. And instead, they try to spread out the pain. And so this is one of the places that the pain goes, except that Dan's absolutely right that, I mean, GE doesn't really have a lot of principle that it can stand on in objecting to the unitary tax. The unitary tax is basically stop cheating, right? That's the message of the unitary tax. Stop cheating. Stop doing things that might get an individual taxpayer in trouble, which is basically reporting your income someplace else other than where you make it, stuff like that. So it's a stop cheating measure. So it's not noxious in its face anyway. But yeah, would it make sense to simplify the tax system a lot more, base it a lot more on income tax, make the burden fall as heavily as possible on higher income people and stop gouging the middle class? Yeah, I'd be all in favor of that. And I think we'd get a clearer sense. The thing that we never have is, like, how much does government cost and what does it take to pay for it? And it seems as though the budgetary process in Connecticut aims at kind of obfuscating those questions as opposed to clarifying them.
But as per usual, we're talking about negotiating with GE about whether or not they're going to take jobs or keep jobs here, not as part of a long-term conversation that we would like to have about tax policy in the state. It's about they're going to move, and now we're going to either give them money or we're not.
Right. Well, this is Malloyism, right? Malloyism, whether it's the Fast Five or something else, is whatever they call it. They call it
the first five.
First Furious
yeah.
Five.
The Fast and Furious
exactly.
Five.
Whatever
first
they're called.
15.
Is actually, yeah.
So it's all about sort of delivering these kind of gift-wrapped packages of credits and abatements and stuff like that to targeted firms, as opposed to, as you say, sort of looking systematically at it. And that then creates this panic cycle that we're in right now. Like, oh, somebody else didn't get what they wanted for Christmas. Although how it could be more Christmas for GE, I just don't know. But
well, and it's not very transparent. If they fixed the tax code, it would be more transparent and it would be predictable and you would know exactly what you're going to pay instead of having to play this game and contact state officials and be like, hey, what kind of deal are you going to give me?
GE can't possibly be considering moving because of its effect on the state income tax. The so-called unitary tax, which isn't a tax, it's a method of reporting tax, the unitary reporting method. Basically, as Colin said, it does make the reporting more transparent, at least to the people who see your returns. It forces a company to look at its entire income over the country and divide that by what sales it has, the unitary in each state. For manufacturers, it actually gives them a benefit. It doesn't make their taxes go up. It can make them go down. For big box stores, it tends to make their taxes in a given state go up if they don't have other operations in that state. So without getting too much into the details of the tax, there's something else here going on. And the something else going on is that because GE was divesting most of GE Capital, which is most of the people who work, most of the 5,700 Connecticut GE employees are with GE Capital. The headquarters is about 800 people. They're thinking, well, you know, we're less connected to Connecticut. And so where should we be? It's a broad sort of epical rethinking rather, I think, than a tax. We don't like this tax.
So last thing on this, though, Dan. A lot of people might say there's been this long history now of the last couple of years. Some company says they're going to leave. The administration throws a bunch of money at them. They stay. There's a bunch of tax breaks involved. And Republicans and many Democrats say that's not what we want to look at in the future. A lot of people are saying, well, then let them leave. Let them go. Whatever. So what's the impact of GE leaves? One of the biggest employers in the country. Certainly they only have so many jobs here in Connecticut. What if GE just gets up and goes?
I think Connecticut gains a lot by having 800 high-paid jobs here in Fairfield. I think there's a cachet to it. I don't tend to like to think that way in economics, but in the case of GE, Connecticut is a corporate headquarters state. We did throw, by the way, in 2014, $30 million at Praxair, a less well-known company, but it came out of the old Union Carbide, for building a $60 million headquarters. Praxair decided this year they're not going to do it, and so it's up in the air. You can absolutely be certain every one of the states that's talking to GE is also quietly talking in Danbury to Praxair. We just don't see it.
Yeah, and Susan Bigelow just tweets at us, I'm reminded of football teams threatening to move to L.A. if they don't get a shiny new stadium. There's that prestige again, Colin. At the end of the day, Danny doesn't like prestige as an economic model, but that's part of why we want to keep GE because, well, it's GE, right? We want to have a new football stadium. It's good for us.
Right. But what Danny said, Danny said about the other part of this is really important, which is this is probably not the driving factor in how GE makes this decision. GE makes this decision for other reasons, but because they put themselves in play, they create this cycle of bad policy. So I mean, I'm sure we don't really know. I mean, I think Andrew Cuomo said something like, there's a lot of love on the table.
A lot of love on the table.
Well, I mean, who knows what that means? But it probably means something really bad for the state of New York. I mean, the state of New York probably shouldn't be putting the financial equivalent of love in this case on the table. It just creates a lot of bad policy around a decision that's probably being made a different way. In other words, GE is making its decisions about relocation for a bunch of reasons that have something to do with tax policy, but a lot to do with a lot of other factors. But the tax policy part of it becomes fetishized by governors who wind up doing really stupid things to their own states.
I love the idea that Dan Malloy is playing In Your Eyes and maybe Andrew Cuomo is playing a Barry White tune with the boombox. So we're talking in the wheelhouse about some of the big news of the week. During his remarks to reporters the other day, Governor Malloy was also asked about the stock market dip on Monday.
You know, I follow that stuff every single day. Having said that, it's an enigma. What specifically is going to drive the market on any given day? Or
we're just going to fade that down. It's a question that got asked by a reporter, Christine Stewart. You were there. I'd never actually really heard the governor of state, not just this governor, but any governor really weigh in and decide to give a long answer. This is a 2-minute and 27-second answer about what happened with the stock market, because it was obviously a big day in the stock market. But why do you answer that?
That was his impression of Jim Cramer.
And that was his Jim Cramer impersonation.
That was, I don't know. It was the first time he had seen the press corps in a while, and he felt like talking about something. So somebody asked him about the stock market, and he made his opinion known.
He decided to go.
We now know that in a Hillary Clinton presidency, Dan Malloy will be appointed to the Department of Transportation or Energy, right. Not Treasury.
Certainly not the Fed.
Right. Not the Fed.
Certainly not the Fed. I mean, I just very, very quickly, Danny, you follow this stuff all the time. I mean, when we see the stock market dip as it has, and there's a lot of fear on Wall Street and in Asian markets, whatever, from the state government standpoint, I mean, I don't know what the governor of Connecticut is supposed to do about it, but, I mean, what do you look at as a columnist who covers this
what
stuff?
What I look at is the expectations of personal income tax receipts by the state state of Connecticut and what this is going to do to that. This is a normal – everybody's saying, and they're right, this is a normal stock correction. This isn't the sign. In 87, the market went down 33% between October and December of 87. We didn't have a recession for another 3 years, and nationally it wasn't that bad a recession. It was bad here for other reasons. So the stock market doesn't drive the economy, and we know that. So we're not, you know, going down the tubes. The U.S. is still the currency of the reserve currency and all that good stuff. Not that we don't have problems, but the point is that Connecticut's state fiscal situation is already, I think, we it's unbalanced for 2017, and we think it may be for 2016, all the more so now.
And looping back to this earlier conversation, Christine, if we're going to rely on high-paying jobs in Fairfield County, that's a very volatile source of income, the income tax in that part of the world. We see a big stock market dip. Maybe it signals a bad year on Wall Street. All of a sudden, things not looking so rosy for this budget year.
So already what they look at when they're putting together the budget and when they look at for projections and estimates are these estimated payments that people make on their income taxes and capital gains. And the stock market drives a lot of that in wealthy people. The income tax is a very volatile tax. And they've set a bar pretty high for estimated payments this year. And it's unclear if they're going to reach that.
So, Bob Engelhardt, if you're listening out there, I'll do your job for you tomorrow. Just take Edward Munch's The Scream and transpose Ben Barnes's face onto it. And that's basically what we're talking about here. I mean, we've already have a permanent state of fiscal crisis. And as Christine and Danny are suggesting, I mean, this simply just ratchets it up.
Just a quick point about the tax receipts. It's not necessarily a straight line that when the market goes down, the receipts go down, because what a lot of people do is take profits. The smart money obviously took profits before the crash. You and I didn't, but some of the smart money.
That's for damn sure.
Right. And so those profits, as the market declines, will be increased. So it's not an easy thing to say that when the market goes down in an extended bear market, you're going to see a decline in receipts. Not necessarily in the first year, but it's something to look at.
Dan Haar is a columnist for the Hartford Current. Christine Stewart is the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. And Colin McEnroe is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. When we come back, we're going to get in line with the DMV. The governor's actually said, don't go to the DMV. The lines are too long as they try to fix their computer system. That's one of the stories we'll talk about next in The Wheelhouse here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're joined by Dan Haar, who's a columnist for the Hartford Current. Christine Stewart is the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. And Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What's in the show today, Colin?
We are doing our long-awaited salute to the octopus. And this is the product of the efforts of Betsy Kaplan, who's our producer. And she's sort of like a method producer. She's like Brando. She becomes the thing that she's producing about. She's getting more and more like an octopus over the last few days. But they are incredibly smart. They have incredibly distinct personalities. I'll tell you one really quick thing. They are so smart that aquariums and other places that have them have to create stuff for them to do, because if they don't have things to do, they'll screw around with the aquarium. They'll get out of their tanks. You have to sort of keep them entertained because they're really, really smart and they'll mess with you otherwise.
We were talking about this in the meeting the other day, and I started to say something negative about octopuses, and Betsy just jumped down my throat. I said I like to eat octopus at like a Spanish restaurant. She's really upset with me. She loves octopuses now.
She likes octopuses better than she likes us.
I think that's fair to say.
Let's just say it. Get it out there.
So that's 1 o'clock this afternoon on the Colin McEnroe Show. Governor Malloy's outgoing chief of staff, Marco Jakian, has his next job lined up. He'll become the fifth leader of the 3-year-old Board of Regents system next month, taking over for Gregory Gray. It sort of seems like that's as often as the Yankees used to change out managers. How is it that we've had so many heads of this Board of Regents system? Does Marco Jakian now taking this over, Christine, sort of settle the boat here at this kind of unusual, brand new part of state government?
You know, possibly. Marco Jakian had a hand in actually creating this agency, creating this oversight of the 4 state university systems and the 12 colleges and the 1 online college. So, he has knowledge. He's an administrator. He's able to negotiate things. We saw with the CBAC negotiations with state employees in 2011. So his contract is for 2 years. And he will have a nice pension if he makes it through those 2 years.
He will indeed have a nice pension. He got a little bit of a raise in salary from the governor's chief of staff to making over $300,000 at the Board of Regents, Colin. I don't know. You know, some people are already saying this is a guy without education experience, but management experience he does certainly have. Maybe he's the right person to head up this department.
Right. He can hardly make things worse. And a lot of this does sit on the lap of the Malloy administration, which kind of they refashioned, reorganized higher education, created this job, or at least made it different from what it used to be. It's always been a problem, although even prior to that, David Carter had what was effectively this job, and he did all kinds of weird, crazy stuff too. I mean, I'm at the point of thinking that their offices, which are very nearby here, they're over on Woodland Street, may be over an Indian burial ground or be possessed by the devil in some way. I mean, they really chronically have problems, worse problems than an agency like this should have. So the first two people have in this somewhat refashioned job have been disasters, just terrible on a whole bunch of different levels. Yeah. Oh, Jakin at least knows how government works. That might help him a little bit.
But it's not as though this is a department that has been around for 30, 40 years, which maybe has had its problems and needs the right leader and is sort of a broken system. This is a brand new system that they created that a lot of people within the system at the state universities, Colin, at all the community colleges have said, this isn't really the setup that we want. UConn is carved out of this. They have their own kind of kingdom over there. Maybe it's just the structure of the thing itself.
Well, I mean, that's a fair question to ask anyway. And certainly the system as it exists now, although it's not that different from the old system, and the old system really had problems anyway. I mean, we have to be honest about that. Pre-Malloy, the way it was set up, it didn't work very well either. And I don't know whether this is – we don't know yet whether this is just really bad personnel choices. Like, I don't know how the changing the system explains why the first guy they hired thought he could do the job from Michigan for part of the year. Remember that? He had, like, a cabin in Michigan, and he thought he could
it
go there.
Minnesota.
So, yeah, Minnesota or wherever
Minnesota.
It was. Okay, so, I mean, what does that have to do with the way they reorganized this system?
When didn't the other guy have the scepter and the
that
orb?
That was David Carter. He's the one with the mace and the –
okay.
Yeah. And so I think this is I don't know that it's the reorganization that's the problem. I think, but their personnel choices have been really awful.
Actually, Michigan was Mike Morris, the CEO of Northeast Utilities, who commuted home to Michigan in 2000 in the company jet, and that was fine because it wasn't public money,
right.
Sort of. The problem, I think, with the structure of the system is not the structure of the system. It's the mission of the system. And we have a mishmash because all organizations are inherently disorganized and chaotic, which they are, but because the Connecticut State University system doesn't know what it wants to be and can't know what it wants to be because there are conflicts. Do you want to be a remedial education to get people barely able to be functioning in the workforce? Do you want to be a high-level liberal arts college learning for its own sake? Do you want to be a training ground? What do you want to be? You have to be all things to all people, and it's hard to organize that.
We're getting a tweet from The Laurel. They cover all things media in the state, and they're begging us not to call Dan Danny. I hope you understand. I'm just going to do it more now.
Yeah.
We're here with Danny
okay.
Haar from the Hartford Courant, Christine Stewart from CT News, Junkie.com. Over the last week, the usual long lines at the Department of Motor Vehicles have gotten even longer. After offices shut down for computer upgrades, people have been lining up outside their local DMV offices like it was a Black Friday shopping spree, some getting there as early as 5 a.m. The governor's now saying, don't even come to the offices until we get this fixed. Do more of your stuff online. Wow, this seems like a whole lot of stuff is broken right now, Christine. Has the administration, has the DMV planned for all this, or is this sort of spun out of control?
This seems to have spun out of control. I mean, they should have had a handle on this and known what was going to happen. And you have to teach people, if you're going to now offer these services online, these people now have to use the services online. And I think a lot of them are still going to the center, going to the, you know, the face-to-face interaction. And, you know, it's confusing. You get this notice in the mail, I accidentally made this mistake, apparently, and the DMV tweeted at me while I was waiting for 2 hours. So I'm waiting for a license renewal. Well, I forgot that you can do a license renewal at the AAA offices.
Of course, and that's what they're telling
so
people.
So that's what DMV tweets at me. And I was like, well, I'm here at the DMV because the paperwork said come to the DMV.
Why isn't, like, I don't know, tweeting dude processing some paperwork?
I don't know.
Okay, that's a good question.
So that is a good question.
Another question is, you know, Governor Malloy said it's a generational thing. You know, a lot of people come to the office because they like to see somebody in person. WNPR reporter Jeff Cohen actually tried to get something done online, and the online system wasn't working exactly as well as it should be either, Colin. I mean, I don't know. What do we make of this?
Well, I guess I'm sort of part of the generation that's supposed to not be able to get this. But my first instinct would be to try to do anything that I could online. And I think that information's out there.
It is.
Whether it reaches everybody or not. And with all deference to Christine, I've been doing my license renewals at AAA for years and years and years and years. I mean, that's not a new idea. That's been around for 8-10 years at least.
And you don't have to belong to AAA, right? You can just get it done at the office.
Yeah, I don't know.
Right.
I belong to AAA. But I think that is true. Yeah. I think you can just walk in there. So a lot of these ideas aren't new. And I think that your analogy holds. I think these people who are showing, I mean, unless your car is in a tow lot, you know, padlocked behind chain link fences and on fire, why would you show up at DMV the first day after they've had this shutdown and they're trying to learn a new computer system? I mean, new computer systems are notorious for slowdowns. This just happened in my doctor's office, you know, and it took me for a routine visit, like a really long time. And my doctor, who's great, he said, it's good you're not here for a physical because that took me 2 hours the other day. Because all the interfaces are new. Everything that was second nature is not second nature anymore. So you've first of all got people in the pipeline who couldn't go to the DMV for a week. So some of them are showing up after they had to wait a week. And you've got workers who for very understandable reasons, aren't as fast but on this system.
Let me just challenge this, Colin. The only thing is a lot of people don't have access to the internet, as we know. And a lot of other people don't pay as close attention to the fact that the DMV might be undergoing a change in the computer system as we do. To a lot of people, it's just like, I got to get this thing done. I go and stand in the line at DMV. I've been doing this for 30 years. Why is it broken today? I think that we assume an awful lot about how much time people have to worry about these issues.
Yeah, although, I mean, maybe that's the price you pay for being the quote-unquote low-information voter, all right? I mean, you know, it's like, you know what? If you don't read the newspaper, if you don't absorb any information, you're going to wait in some lines that you probably don't have to wait in.
Yeah, there are a couple of reasonably simple solutions. I would start by saying I'm absolutely the wrong person to talk about this. In, I think, 2006 or 2007, I found myself with my car towed. My license had expired a year earlier. My car was unregistered. the thing that really
you
took
had an
me,
armed robbery warrant.
Yeah, the
on
thing,
you
no, the thing that really took me time was that the
if
the
you're
inspection,
wanted by the police, you yeah. shouldn't be on the radio
the
right now, Danny.
No, I'm not. I had it taken care of, but okay. I had to make, I think, 6 trips back and forth to do one thing at a time, and I had a temporary license and all that stuff. So I'm sort of an administrative terrorist. But I will say seriously, what they could do to make this a little bit easier going forward is they could put up computer system Carol, where you go and you're there. And the big sign that says, do you need to be here? And you punch in your thing. And if it says, go home and do this online, you can do what you need to do online.
But don't they kind of do that
online
already? I mean, they
no,
have
you
a
have
kind
to
of
wait
trial
for 3 hours well, to get to the person who says.
Yeah, there is a triage
right,
that
yeah,
you go
right
through, right?
But the triage
yeah
line was, I understand, I wasn't there, but our reporting, I think, did you see that?
The triage line was very, very long.
That's the thing that was really long. Yeah,
yeah. That's the problem. So you don't even know if you should be there
right
or not be there.
Right.
And, you know.
But one thing we know is that there are, you know, back to John's analogy, there are people who will show up at 3 a.m. the day after Thanksgiving, ready to gouge each other's retinas out to get a discounted KitchenAid standing blender. So, I mean, maybe you just have a phenomenon here where, I mean, one letter writer of The Current, this is my favorite one. There have been all kinds of letters to The Current about this. But one guy, after complaining about all this and saying the website didn't work very well, he concluded, I wish Donald Trump were running for governor of Connecticut. You know, because Donald Trump is so good at debugging systems, streamlining bureaucracies. He has so much experience. Like, that guy deserves to wait in line for 16 hours.
Look, I just have to ask one last thing, Christine. I had Kevin Lembo, the state comptroller, on the other day. He's undergoing a new system having to do with state pensions. There's a new system that they're still trying to get the bugs out of around the DSS. It seems as though a lot of computer systems at the state level are coming up, right? 40 years, 30 yeah years, and we're fixing them all at once. And I don't know, it has to happen. I'm going to sort of maybe agree with Colin on some of this stuff and say, you know, we're going to have to change over these systems eventually. Maybe we put up a little bit of long lines for a couple weeks because we've got to come into at least the late part of the 20th century, if not the 21st.
No, we definitely do. And there are glitches in all of these systems, and they are trying to upgrade them and, you know, progress has to move forward, and they have to get there.
I blame John Ruland. Actually, I've been wondering whether this is Rock Regan's fault. Remember Rock Regan? He was John Ruland's IT czar who was supposed to fix everything, and he didn't. I haven't had the time to check this out. I want to know at some point, because I believe that everything is John Ruland's fault, whether this is one of the reasons it took so long for DMV to upgrade.
The state does have a new website, too.
We should ring a bell every time we blame something on John Ruland here. Now, you just actually mentioned some of the comments in the Hartford Courant's website. Gets us to one last thing in this segment here. In the months leading up to and since the CT Fast Track, the busway, as we know it, launched, the State Department of Transportation was promoting it everywhere, including on this station. But a new report from the AP finds that at least one DOT official was promoting the system a little bit more covertly. The department's transit administrator was using stage names to post comments to the Hartford Courant's website, Dan?
Well, we don't necessarily like that, but we welcome all comments.
What is your sock puppet name?
Sock puppet name is Doobie McDowell.
Milty Friedman.
I'm known as Doobie McDowell. So
what was happening here was essentially going on the comment section saying, yeah, this Fast Track is going to be awesome.
Yeah, what I couldn't get from the story yesterday was this guy doesn't seem to be very ashamed of this. His answer was, well, this is a really important thing here. So it's not clear to me whether this is an officially state-sanctioned activity or not. I think it is.
I agree. I think that I did speak with some DOT employees, and they were all getting up at like 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning and going out to the busway in the first few weeks and being ambassadors to the busway.
Yeah, but being a busway ambassador and wearing, a green shirt and saying, hey, support the busway, that's one thing. Getting on and using a false name to try to gin up support for it on the poor Hartford Courant website, it doesn't seem like, I don't know, the right way to do things. Am I wrong about this?
Are we talking about Mike Sanders? Is he a little over-exuberant?
Well, Mike Sanders is a really good guy. You know, I mean, actually, he's a very nice guy, but he certainly has misjudged this situation in every possible way. So, yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that John's suggesting, this is called in the world of the internet sock puppetry or being a sock puppet. And you can get into trouble for it in certain jobs. Journalists who've become sock puppets occasionally to praise their own work and stuff like that have gotten in a lot of trouble for it. I don't think Sanders will be getting in as much trouble. I have to say, though, it's a wonderful, happy day. And I want to congratulate the 20 or so commenters who make up about 80% of the commenting on the Hartford Courant website. You're reading at the fourth grade level in Mississippi. You can't spell anything. Your minds are full of hate. But a state official actually thought it was worth disguising himself to go on that comment thread and talk to you. You've got to be feeling incredibly validated. You're going to probably have to ask somebody what validated means, but it's a wonderful day. I mean, really going on the Hartford Courant comment thread to, you know, help your cause as a DOT official, it's like posting a missing cat notice in Dante's third ring of hell. You know, you're unlikely to get people who are going to help you find your cat, and you're unlikely to motivate people to like your busway.
Colin McEnroe hosts the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. He's, I think, a former columnist now for the Hartford Courant. Any comment? Quickly, Danny.
I wonder whether I'm being called upon to defend our comment.
I am.
Should I ask you that? Let me say that the only thing I can say is that if you had listened to these people in the first place, we wouldn't be in the jam we're in.
Dan Haar writes a column for the Hartford Courant. Christine Stewart is editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. We'll be back with Colin McEnroe right after this break. We'll be talking about Dan Malloy in New Hampshire stumping for Hillary Clinton at a time when Hillary Clinton's campaign isn't maybe going so well. We'll also say goodbye to Don Orsill, longtime broadcaster of the Boston Red Sox. Oh, we're not happy about that. On the Wheelhouse, where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, Hartford Mayor Pedro Segarra is in the midst of a tight re-election campaign against Democratic challenger Luke Bronin. After walking out on his party's endorsement convention, Segarra gathered enough votes to get on the ballot for the September primary. He'll stop by our studios to discuss his record, plans for the future of Hartford, and the close race. Coming up in a couple of weeks, we'll be talking with Luke Bronin as we try to delve into the Hartford mayor's race. Our own Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, has been doing yeoman's work talking to the candidates for Bridgeport mayor. Yeah. And you can find those all online at WNPR.org. Just go to the Colin McEnroe Show. He's here with us today in the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, along with Christine Stewart, the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com, and Dan Haar, columnist for the Hartford Current. So this week, along with a lot of other things he's got on his plate, Dan Malloy went to New Hampshire to stump for Hillary Clinton. This comes as Vice President Joe Biden considers his own bid. Bernie Sanders continues to draw huge crowds around the country. I mean, what do we make, Colin, of Dan Malloy getting on the Hillary Clinton train at a time when that train is kind of a little bit off its tracks?
Before I say anything about Hillary Clinton, let me just say Bernie Sanders, Bernie Sanders, Bernie Sanders. Because if you don't do that, you get barraged by Bernie Sanders lunatics because you're not talking enough about him. So anyway, one of the questions about Dan Malloy for a while has been, is he angling for something? Is he kind of bored with governing Connecticut and participating in conversations about DMV lines and getting yelled at about a lot of stuff and dealing with intractable problems and having to suck up to GE? Wouldn't it be more fun to do something else? And I've tended to not really put a lot of stock in all that, but I feel as though recently it kind of looks as though that, you know, back to Danny's joke a little while ago, maybe he would like a cabinet position in a Hillary Clinton administration that, you know, and that there may be some – I mean, obviously, as head of the DGA, he's got to do this stuff. That's part
right.
of his job. So it's
and
not
the
like
Democratic Governors Association is raising money for the 2016 campaign for around the country, really.
Plus, the National Democratic Party has no bench. You know, I mean, they have very, very few people that they can rely on for this kind of thing. And the Republicans have 162 people running for president and then a whole bunch of other people. The Republicans are beneficiaries of kind of what I call Reagan babies. These are people like Marco Rubio and Scott Walker and Paul Ryan, who were sort of teenagers and coming into adulthood when it was, quote unquote, cool to be a Republican because Reagan was president and people really liked Ronald Reagan. And I'm assuming that there may be a kind of Clinton version of that, you know, people who are 10 years behind a cohort. But right now, there aren't that many good voices. There's the Castro brothers and they're among governors. I think there are only 18 Democratic governors out of a possible 50. So Dan Malloy is very necessary just to have somebody who can go out there and say some of this stuff and do some of this visibility stuff. It's important to have a guy like him.
And when you talk about a bench, we often think of a bench meaning other people who could line up to make a presidential bid. As you've said in the past, Colin, part of a bench is having a well-rounded bench, a guy who, like in a hockey brawl, can come off and get onto the ice and throw a few punches, and he's done a very good job of that for the Democratic Party.
That's been his role so far, is to be the hockey goon. Now, I think up in New Hampshire, you see him doing something a little bit different. I think he needs to prove and wants to prove he can do something other than slap Bobby Jindal around.
So is he really thinking about this, Christine, or what?
Yeah, and I think that it's difficult to be a surrogate for somebody as opposed to running as a candidate for yourself. So I think he's kind of testing himself up there to see what it is like to stump for somebody else. And, you know, and I heard from people he recently went down and spoke at a conference in Maryland, and I heard from some people down there who said they thought that he was very nice. And what are you talking about, this big, bad, angry Dan Malloy?
But part of the role of being a surrogate is people are going to ask you things about something that somebody else has done a while
True.
Ago, and then you have to defend that thing. And so he goes to New Hampshire, as Tucker tweets to me actually here, he was holding a dog in New Hampshire. That's the sort of thing I guess you do when you're on the campaign trail for someone, holding dogs, kissing babies, but also answering questions about Hillary Clinton's emails
Yes.
and having to say, it's not such a big deal.
Right. No, I think that's, he was prepped, I'm sure, by the Hillary Clinton campaign as to exactly how to answer some of those questions.
I think he, in that answer, in regard to Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, overstated the case. They did not use their own servers, as Mark Pazniokas reported. They did use their personal emails, but that's not at all the same thing as what we're talking about with Hillary.
Right.
So one of the beauties of politics, especially in the early sessions is you can pretty much say what you want, and you know, if you're the surrogate, because the Hillary campaign has nothing to do with Dan Malloy.
And just to maybe pull back a little bit from Connecticut, Colin, I'll just say, as we watch Dan Malloy there, we're sort of watching, I think, a concurrent situation happen. Joe Biden may be getting in, and then there's just Hillary Clinton's campaign. It's just the way in which she does or does not connect to people. The polls that keep coming out about how people react to her personally, almost nothing is lining up seemingly right now in Hillary Clinton's favor. That all said, there's a very, very long time, and she's raising an awful lot of money.
Yeah, and I mean, sort of a game that some of my friends like to play is the game of sort of imagining a Democratic convention or something like that, or a primary field where there were some other candidates, where there was an Al Gore, a Joe Biden. You know, who would you vote for then? You know, and when you do that, you see that support for Hillary Clinton. You know, it's not the lock that it seemed to be even 6 months ago. It's been a lock for a long time because there are so few other alternatives, Bernie Sanders, right now. but the idea of Biden getting in seems more and more plausible and realistic with each passing day.
And Christine, just the last thing, I mean, are we going to expect here in Connecticut where obviously a lot of this doesn't really matter in the 2016 presidential race? You know, whoever the Democratic nominee is will be voted on overwhelmingly probably by Connecticut voters. But, I mean, does our state, aside from Governor Malloy going out and stumping, does it play any real role in this big upcoming race?
You know, I don't see it playing a huge role yet. You know, obviously the candidates always come here. We're, you know, the nation's ATM. You know, so they always come here to raise money. But I don't see Connecticut playing a big role until we can get further up in the primaries.
Well, I think as the bluest state, Connecticut has a role to play nationally by, in this case, sending our emissary to other states. And just sort of in a broad, abstract, theoretical way, Connecticut is the bluest state when you look at the elected officials in Connecticut, both inside and representing us in Washington. And so there's a role in that sense as a sort of a bulwark of liberalism. A lot of people in Connecticut don't agree with that, but that's a more sort of a broader way, I think, of thinking about it.
We're going to end the program today saying goodbye to a few baseball institutions. The New Britain Rockcats say goodbye to New Britain this weekend in a homestand against the Portland Sea Dogs. The Hartford Courant's Don Amore interviewed a longtime owner, Bill Dowling, recently. He told the team that the owners who decided to move the team to Hartford said it's very sad. It's sad for the people of New Britain. It's sad for the people who've been there. But having said that, life goes on. Hopefully they'll be fortunate enough to get another team in there and they can replicate the Rock Cats experience. Essentially what's happening, Colin, is the team's moving a couple miles down the road to a fancy new stadium in Hartford. And that means New Britain, this little gritty city, doesn't have a baseball team anymore.
Right. And this is kind of the sports version of what we were talking about with GE and other companies right now, right? You can just you shop around for a better deal and a shinier stadium. The notion of being a good citizen, you know, I mean, if you go back to my early adulthood in Hartford, we still had the bishops, you know, these guys who were heads of corporations who really sort of believed in the city, believed in corporate citizenship, believed in a certain amount of loyalty. It was a system not without flaws, but it was a different kind of system. And everything now is up for grabs. Everything is in play, whether it's a sports franchise or your corporate headquarters. Everybody's shopping for a better deal. Nobody seems to have much loyalty to anything.
And, you know, the loyalty for a lot of people, Danny, to the New Britain Rockcats, in part, even though as the Boston Red Sox took their minor league affiliation out of there and they became a Minnesota Twins affiliate for many, many years, so maybe there wasn't the direct connection to a lot of people in the area, the people of New Britain still said, hey, this is our ball team. We built a little stadium here to bring people in, and it's not Hartford. It's not Farmington or any other town around here. It's New Britain, darn it, and we liked having a ball team, and now it's gone.
It's still their ball team. This is a 12-mile radius. If you were in Minneapolis at the location of the Yard Goat Stadium that's going up right now, and you drove the 12-mile distance to in southwest toward another location, you would probably still be in Minneapolis. So it's really one market. I don't know why we're—
But you just talked about prestige and GE. I mean, it says the New Britain Rockcats. When you look at the AA baseball
prestige
standings, people all over the Northeast now know where New Britain is. It's the home of Stanley Tools, the New Britain Rockcats. It means something to a small town.
Prestige doesn't extend to a parking lot on the edge of town on the Kensington City line. That's not part of prestige. That's a market that we're in right now. We have a baseball team. The question is whether New Britain will, as it has a right, to bring in an Atlantic League team, which would really compete heavily with the Yard Goats. That would be two teams of roughly equivalent ability, but the Atlantic team is a bottom feeder because it's independent. That would be really tough on the Yard Goats.
And you brought us one little piece of trivia here, Danny, which is important to transition us to our next
yes.
story here.
Yes.
Last night at the Rockcats Stadium, what happened?
Yastrzemski's grandson hit a home run to beat the Rockcats.
So actually, Carl Yastrzemski's—
And if that doesn't make you feel old, I don't know what.
Carl Yastrzemski's grandson is playing for the Bowie Bay Sox and beat the Rockettes last night with a home run. So there we go. Okay, on to the last baseball story. We're going to take a couple of minutes with this, Colin, because I think it's an important one for a lot of people in the area. As many of you know, I'm a fan of the Pittsburgh Pirates. I grew up in Pittsburgh. And for the first time in a while, it's actually a good time to be a Pirates fan. But ever since I moved to Boston in the early 1990s, the Red Sox have been my American League team. They overcame their curses, of course, and became great once again over the course of the last 15 years. This last year or so, the team stinks. Their former GM is building a powerhouse in Christine Stewart's Chicago Cubs. And their former star pitcher Curt Schilling is trying to out-Trump Donald Trump in a game of who can I offend today? And now, Colin, we hear this. Beloved Boston Red Sox announcer Don Orsillo has been let go. The reaction's been swift. What's your reaction?
Well, mine is one of mourning. And certainly, yes, I mean, to echo what you're saying, so the Red Sox have a lot of problems right now. They have a morbidly obese third baseman. They've got a guy playing left field who's very unfamiliar with fly balls. And they got a pitching staff that couldn't get Carl Yastrzemski's grandmother out. So the solution, get rid of your announcer. Good thinking, guys. And, I mean, really, these last 2 years have been sort of agony as a Red Sox fan. But the team of Don Orsillo and usually Jerry Remy. Jerry Remy's had a lot of health problems, and his son was basically convicted for murder. You know, because of those things, Orsillo has worked with a lot of other partners, most delightfully with Dennis Eckersley, with whom I enjoy him even more than with Remy. But they've sort of become our friends, and our friends during a fairly, you know, depriving and unpleasant period. And Orsillo is just he's a great straight man when he's working with somebody funny. He's a guy who takes just delight, as I think we're about to hear, in stuff that goes on, little things that go on in the game. He's just been a pleasure and a gentleman, and he's had to work with a lot of complicated transitions because of all of Remy's problems. He's worked, I think, with 36 or something like that, different partners, and he's just been a pro through the whole thing.
You know, for those of you wondering why we love Don so much, in case you don't know his work, give a listen to this clip, one of many we could have chosen of him laughing along with broadcast partner Jerry Remy. Just to set it up, there's a little kerfuffle in the stands, and one guy was shown in instant replay to be throwing pizza at another guy. Let's just listen.
But here comes a pizza, see it? Oh, jeez.
Highly unnecessary.
Guy with the Patriots jacket, and of course he's been asked to leave the ball game for ruining a good piece of pizza. Get beer all over him. And here goes
some pizza.
The sound of Don Orsillo's laugh, and there's I don't know, Dan, we could play clip after clip after clip of that. And I think the thing is that sometimes when we take sports so seriously, we forget it's about joy. It's about enjoying things. And there is so much pure joy in just listening to that little bit of tape.
You know, the Yankee fans had Phil Rizzuto and cannolis. And the Red Sox fans have, you know, pizza. I think we forget that the players are not stable. We've been talking a lot about instability today in various forms. The players on a team are not what's stable. What's stable is the voices of the team, and that's why it's a really big deal for the Red Sox to do what they're doing and dumb.
You know, we got a lot of reaction last night on Twitter. Senator Chris Murphy says, I will watch Red Sox games on Nesson less often without Don Orsillo. I don't think I'm alone. Our friend Jerry Brooks from NBC says, Orsillo's out. Bad move, Nesson and Red Sox. As Ned Martin would say, mercy. Our friend Dan Kennedy says, if any CN execs really believe that Don Orsillo had anything to do with the declining ratings, they're insane. And sports columnist Bill Simmons, recently out at ESPN, says the Red Sox had run out of ways to confuse their fans these past 18 months, so they decided, let's get rid of Don Orsillo. Hey, Colin, maybe we are overblowing some of this in just the last minute or so we have, but I think Danny makes a really good point. There is so little in our society that we actually have stable, that we can count on day after day, year after year. Our baseball team in New Britain leaves after a while. That's okay. We got to hop on the busway and go down the street. But that does confuse a lot of people, and it does make us upset. When a voice goes away, one that's part of our summers for so many years, it actually means something to people.
Yeah, New England people don't like change very much. And you think about kids, too. Like, I grew up listening to Ned Martin and Ken Coleman, and I mean, they were the broadcasters for a really long time. Back to Danny's point about stability. They become part of your childhood if you're a kid growing up in New England. And I'm sure that's what Orsillo is for a lot of New England kids. And the other thing is, he's just such a class act. That, you know, he's really one of the few people connected to the Red Sox who actually did his job properly over the last couple of years. It just seems a shame that I just don't even understand how he's the person singled out for non-renewal.
Well, Don Orsillo, you've always got a home here at WNPR. Colin McEnroe is the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, talking about octopuses this afternoon at 1 o'clock. Colin, thanks so much for joining us.
Can't wait.
Christine Stewart is the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. She grew up in the Midwest, so she's a Chicago Cubs fan. As long as they lose to the Pirates in the playoffs, I'm just fine with that, Christine. Good to see you.
Thanks, John.
And Danny Haar is a columnist for the Hartford Current. Thanks, as always, Dan. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks to the cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network, who were here today. Our program is produced by Tucker Ives, with help from Lydia Brown, Betsy Kaplan, and Josh Nalea. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer of WNPR's Where We Live is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky. Tomorrow, Pedro Segarra, the mayor of Hartford, running for re-election. Hope you can join us where we live.